the monarch of Britain, okay, and the monarch of Germany were cousins. All right. So there's all kinds of different levels in chess games being played, right. Yeah. But I don't want to assume, oh, the Germans were fighting the British. I mean, at the highest levels, it's just a poker game. It's just a chess game, and they play with people's lives. All right. But essentially, he was saying, look, the Zionists in London, they went to the British war cabinet, and they said, look, you can still win this war. What you need to do is you need to get the U.S. to come in on your side. And then he says that they basically said, we'll guarantee to bring the United States into the war as your ally to fight with you on your side if you promise us Palestine after you win the war. Now, that's all fine and well, right? Anybody can make this kind of a claim. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. It's thought-provoking, but do we have any evidence to corroborate this? And it just so happens that we do. In fact, we can go to the Rothschilds archive once again to a source that was literally an inside man. And what do they state here? This is the Rothschild archive. Just look up Walter Rothschild in the Balfour Declaration, Origins in the First World War, and explains that the British hoped that in exchange for their support of Zionism, quote-unquote, the Jews would help to finance the growing expenses of the First World War, which was becoming increasingly burdensome.
Welcome to Far Out with Faust, everybody. I am Faust Chicho, and today I am excited and delighted and honored to be joined once again by my friend, Gavin Nascimento. If you guys caught my first episode with Gavin way back, Gavin is an intelligence analyst virtually without peer. He's one of the best that I know. He's a conspiracy realist. He's known for his incredible attention to detail and his adherence to facts. Double, triple, quadruple checking everything. He sticks to what can be proved, and I'm delighted to have him back on my show. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in this world and where that conflict started that's happening right now with Israel and Palestine and the Palestinian people. So without further ado, thanks for beaming in, brother. It's great to have you back on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, man. I'm looking forward to this. I know it's a very sensitive, emotional, and evocative topic, but I'm hoping that I can pull people out of that emotional storm and into a bit of a calmer, more practical place where you can assess things from a critically human perspective, one that goes beyond tribalism.
Agreed. And let me say this right off the bat. You know, I am absolutely in condemnation of violence, and my heart goes out to all those people who are suffering right now, both Israeli and Palestinian. I am on the human team, you know, and I want that to be clear. You know, I look out for the oppressed and people who are being picked on and the underdog. That has always been my nature. And I want everyone to understand that this is not about picking sides. It's about attempting to shed light on history and some of the things that we aren't taught in school, but that have in fact gone on, you know, and have been recorded and proved. And so that I just wanted to preface everything we do and talk about today with that statement. So that
amen to that, brother.
Yeah,
100%, man. Let's try to keep this human, and we can all unequivocally and overwhelmingly agree in essentially the principles that you're laying out, which is that, you know, you want to protect the innocent, the vulnerable from the bully. And unfortunately, when it comes to politics and when it comes to religion, which is a predecessor of politics, they were interchangeable in the past. And over here, they are enmeshed very closely. They are acculturated together. It becomes a bit more difficult to ascertain specifically what the scenario is. There's a lot of gaslighting. There's a lot of propaganda. There's a lot of misinformation. And so we're going to do our very best to keep this human, our pursuit about what is right from a human perspective, and pursue the objective truth and where it may lead.
I'm with you. Let's go down that rabbit hole, my friend.
All right.
Where should we start, Gavin? You know, I mean, because there's a lot of places.
Tell me, I see there's a share screen button. Does this? So this shares screen. Can I share screen with this? Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, cool. Because what I would like to actually do is I have slides that I've put together, and we won't just do slides. We won't do a slide heavy presentation, but for the sake of accuracy, I would like to start with the whole promised land concept, and then we can methodically begin from the roots of where this narrative comes from, and critically assess it, and then we'll slowly lead into the history. We'll go into World War One. We'll go into all of the division and just the madness that has gone on there, and one step at a time. Okay, so we are actually. Let me start with this as a quick preface, as you were saying, before we properly get started. So we see over here, this is obviously King Leopold and what is recognized now as the genocide that took place in the Belgian Congo. All right. So what happened with this historically, just to give a little bit of context before we move forward, because it's nice to have a little bit of history to rely on, is that King Leopold, who is in fact a descendant of the British royals, of the Windsor family, he, during the scramble for Africa, he said he wanted to go into the Congo on like a purpose and a mission for God. He wanted to protect the vulnerable and the innocent there. And he embarked on an incredibly carefully complex, coordinated propaganda campaign that went on for over a decade, in which he convinced the public around the world that he was indeed doing just that. And along the way, people that began to become aware that, no, this guy's actually lying. There are terrible, horrible, oppressive things taking place in the Belgian Congo. And anybody that's not familiar, I encourage you to look it up. It is terrible. Millions of people died. And it was just a brutal regime. In fact, some of the crimes that go on there to this very day, hands getting cut off and so on and so forth, it can be traced back to this particular period. And so there was a huge propaganda war and a huge information war between himself and people that were going in there and becoming aware of what was taking place. And they tried to sound the alarm bells. They tried to blow the whistle. But as you can imagine, when somebody has a great deal of power and influence over the media, and this is the New York Times, the big establishment media outlets, they were lying to the benefit for the protection of King Leopold. So for over a decade, he managed to conceal this truth from society, and he did it under the auspices of religion. Now, that's not to say people sometimes they get this very confused and they'll say, oh, you know, the evil there is religion. No, the evil there is the person that claimed that they were religious, the predator, the proverbial wolf in the sheep's clothing. And very ironically, when he was exposed, one of the key technological inventions that led to his exposition was the Kodak camera, because it developed a photo and it showed what was really going on. And the couple behind this was a missionary couple. So you have one element where it's a predator, he's got the cloak on of Christianity, and then you've got the missionaries, and they're also Christian. So it's not necessarily about the religion, but I wanted to point this out so people can understand that you get people in this world, they have no moral compass, and they engage in this Machiavellian kind of politics where they will utilize our belief, our desire to side with what we perceive to be humanity, to be good, to be aligned with truth, and then they can commit horrible atrocities. And unless we are willing to question that earnestly, openly, and objectively, we won't be able to find out what's really going on. All right, so with that said, let's go ahead. I'm going to start with this initial share over here. Just bear with me. There it is. Okay, so we're going to start with the actual promised land scripture. Now, I know Wikipedia can be extremely duplicitous. It's not my first chosen source, but I mean, this does represent the most popular library in human history. And this is not a difficult scripture to corroborate and ascertain. So the promised land, it's, you can find it in obviously the Old Testament of the Bible, and then also in the Torah of Judaism, which is also based on the Old Testament, right? And essentially, just to do a quick summation, this is the claim that Abraham in the Middle East, the Abrahamic religions, which descend from the individual called Abraham, God will give them this proverbial promised land. All right, so that's where it starts from. And you see, if you go a little bit further down, Jewish interpretation, the concept of the promised land is the central national myth of Zionism. So now what we need to do immediately is we need to go ahead and explore this specific passage. And then we need to also explore a bit about how this passage was tabulated and how it came to be. So the first thing to point out here, guys, and just to get quick confirmation, can you see everything that I'm sharing here?
I can, yeah.
Okay, 100%. Immediately, what we need to understand is the patriarch of this promised land narrative is Abraham. But Abraham was not even born in Palestine or in the land of Israel, which back then was Canaan. He was born in Iraq. So from a pragmatic perspective, what I would like to do, just to stop for a moment and pause there, is I would like people to believe, to ask themselves, let's say that you are a Christian or you are a Jew. If there's a Muslim person that in their Quranic text, they state that they have a right to your specific homeland because one of their patrons, one of their patriarchs, who wasn't actually born in that land, now has a right to it. From, I mean, beyond religion, remove religion from the equation. Does that seem okay to you? Based on their belief system that this is okay? Of course not. But it gets worse. Okay, this is, and it starts to get worse. So now we're going to start to pick it apart and get into the fact that essentially it starts to amount to ancient propaganda. So this is the first, okay, the book of Genesis is the first book in the Bible. Like I said, the texts of the Judaic texts are also from the Old Testament. And so it starts in the book of Genesis where God has this covenant, right, with Abram. And he says, this is Genesis 15, verse 18, on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, to your descendants, I give this land. And then he names all these different tracts of land. And as you can see there, the Canaanites, right? Now, immediately, if people can, whatever religion you align yourself with, you don't have to be religious, but people that are religious can fall into the trappings of tribalism in this particular regard. Again, ask yourself, if this was coming from the so-called other side, would it be okay? And this is where it gets worse. So initially it starts off with, oh, I'm going to give this land, right? But we fast forward to Deuteronomy 20, verse 16. And then it starts to degenerate into an act of genocide. Okay. Here we go. Deuteronomy 20, chapter 16. However, in the cities of the nations the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance, do not leave alive anything that breathes.
Wow.
That's an act of genocide, guys. Okay, and just for further clarification, people can also go ahead and look up 1 Samuel 15:2-3, where it explains, now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both men and women, infant and suckling. And I welcome anybody to go look into whatever interpretation you like of this biblical text, because it's very unambiguous. Oxen, sheep, camel, and ass. All right, so let's take a moment to pause and explore this from a human perspective. So here we have, in this text, essentially the author of the text, and which is, by the way, it's a point of great contention. People are not in agreement. The historic scholars are not in agreement that that book was actually authored by Moses.
I'm sure there's good reason for that, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a good reason for that, because you can't document your own death, which is what happens in those first five books. And removing the religious component of this, that sounds very much like what a modern-day propagandist would do. And it's so significant for people to understand that the mentality that dominates a human being and the different personalities, what is today true was true 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, and beyond. The ruling class conducted themselves with the same methodologies, with the same characteristics, and so did propagandists. Mm-hmm. Now, when you read that from a moral perspective, guys, we all know that that's obviously wrong. If you read, if somebody says, based on the Quran, okay, I like to use this as an example.
Right.
If it says in the Quran that, oh, we can take this land through an act of genocide by killing babies, is that okay? Of course not. And this takes us to the golden rule. And the golden rule is not just central to Christianity, Judaism, and so many other teachings. I suppose I don't have to share a screen on that one. But the golden rule is essentially do unto others as you would have That's them right. do unto you, which is it's so imperative and important. And the thing about, let's say, the Bible and so many other religions is there are so many different interpretations, guys.
Yeah.
According to the Bible itself and the Christian religion, the last time I checked, there are 45,000 different denominations, and that's a lower estimate.
Wow.
Okay, 45,000. That means that there are tens of thousands of different interpretations. And let me be very clear, guys. When it comes to articulating the truth, when it comes to sharing the truth, as somebody that I have made this my job for over 10 years, you do your very best to be unambiguous, which is to say to be precise. And when you know where there can be multiple interpretations, because you want to make the truth very clear and you want to give people clarity, you do your best to remove any misinterpretations. So that's a red flag. This then, let me first, before we move to that point. So initially, what I'm saying is you have all of these different interpretations. If there's one that I would certainly say that should be revered above others is do unto others as they would do unto you. And the proverbial kingdom of heaven is within. And what I mean by that is a Bible, a Quran, a book, it is subject to human interpretation, and it is also subject to human propagation, meaning that it can be edited, it can be changed, and a clever propagandist can weaponize it for their own purpose. And historically, that has taken place.
Yeah.
Whereas what you have deep within you, which we do have a moral blueprint. I like to refer people to the studies of Professor Paul Bloom of Yale University on babies as young as 3 months old. That shows we literally have a moral blueprint, irrespective of skin color, irrespective of the religion that we were born into. So immediately we know, unfortunately, that doesn't vibe with me. And I know as somebody who used to identify as being a Christian, and just as a quick little statement there for everybody to be aware of, I used to believe that the Israeli government was like the good guy in all of this.
Right.
So it's important to recognize that as I take you down this journey, it's a journey I myself have taken. And anyways.
Yeah. And I second that as well, because I had a Catholic upbringing, and you know, the stories I heard growing up were always that The Jews were the chosen people led out of Israel by God, right. You know, God's messenger, and
comes from a place of religious conviction and good and earnest conviction. You know, it's a very human thing. But unless we question it, because never underestimate the power of deception, guys, and the power of those who mean harm. And unfortunately, those who mean harm are the ones that have the upper hand at this point in time and day and age. And just very quickly, before we do start to move beyond questioning this particular verse, the modern day Bible was tabulated in the 4th century under the Council of Nicaea and under the authority of Constantine the Great, who, this dude was not a good guy. He killed his own son, he killed his wife. And just as Google, which is the most popular search engine in the world, is highly edited, highly manipulated, so is Wikipedia, for the purpose of propaganda,
right,
for ensuring that the narrative and public perception is controlled. Right. So too through the Council of Nicaea, because there was this very subversive Christian demographic, which we know very little bit about because they largely suppressed their teachings.
Right.
So through the Council of Nicaea, what they went ahead and did was they tabulated what we recognize as the Bible today. And there were tons
very
of
meticulously.
Oh yes, very meticulously. They went ahead and they got rid of certain texts and they put other texts in. And if you read the proceedings of how the Bible was tabulated, it wasn't done in a free flow exchange of information where the best ideas naturally rise to the top. No. It was done through authoritarianism. It was done through essentially ganging up. And if they didn't like what this person had to say, well, he was excommunicated or they got rid of him. And I want you to ask yourself, just again, from a place of critical assessment, from that proverbial kingdom within you, does that make sense? No. Because in order to understand the truth, it doesn't require this mystical process that they've led us into delusionally believing. And truth is, it's a very simple thing, guys. And there's certain principles that need to be pursued and followed. And one of those is that there needs to be a free-flowing exchange of information. That's right. That when there is a corrupt authority in a position to control the narrative, they naturally are going to create a narrative that benefits them and not those that are subversive or the common people that are striving for truth.
That's right.
And this, and just one more thing, and this is historically accurate of what took place with the predecessors to the Roman Empire, because just to give a quick motive here, these individuals, they were proving to be a problem for the Roman establishment because they refused to bow down to the empire, to the emperor, which was essentially glorified as a deity. And that was central to the whole mythology of their authority, to their power. And the most dangerous thing to any establishment historically has been somebody that will not obey and will not comply. Not
afraid, right.
Yes. And so naturally they came to use this because his predecessors, such as Diocletian, even Nero, they try to prosecute the early Christians, but it didn't work because
right.
a subversive spirit cannot be stamped out. And so by refusing to obey, that demonstrates a problem that they cannot contend with. So they right. found a way to instead co-opt the movement. That's something that's very much going on even in modern times with social media. Mm-hmm. So now that we can understand and at least question, okay, that narrative, it's predicated on genocide. This book was originally tabulated under highly dubious circumstances. Then we can begin to question it intelligently and then move forward from right. there to scrutinize more modern day events taking place.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so must I just roll with it?
Yeah, let's roll with it. I mean, I could get into it, but I want to get to modern day because I know most people are gonna be tuning in to try to get more of a perspective of what's happening for whatever reason, you know.
Yes, 100%. Okay, well, what I want to do, because it's equally important, the thing is with like this conflict in particular, the history is paramount, and not just what we went through. That's small stuff,
right?
But this is the first step because there's always going to be that group that rabidly cling to that interpretation, but it's highly dubious, you know, from an introductory right. human perspective. You can't genocide.
It's funny because, you know, the same people who call the Muslims savages because there's a few verses in the Quran about infidels, which they love to quote and you know, jihad and all this. Meanwhile, you know, there's many, many verses right there 100%. In their Bible, which are equally as, you know,
psychopathic. 100%. So I'd like to also just point out to everybody that myself, I have actually read the Bible front to back, the Old Testament, which is very long. I've read it on several occasions, and then the New Testament about 24 times. And not just read it, but I've studied it. I've looked at it with scholars. It's the first book that I actually ever read front to back, and I understood it, okay, at the age of 15. So I'm not in a position where I'm just being critical. This is something that I have meticulously researched, and I always tell people, don't just get hung up on researching and looking at what is in the Bible. You need to research how the Bible was put into position, the history surrounding it, because that's where you start to really figure things out a bit better. It's and so at important. The same time, yeah, 100%. And at the same time, I'm not saying that it's all deception. There's some really good stuff in the Bible. There's some good philosophy. Yeah. There's some powerful truths. But even a broken clock is right twice a day. Even Fox News will share the truth occasionally. Even MSNBC will share the truth occasionally. And that's how a skilled deception works. And
that's right.
There's a lot of deception in there. But anyways, moving forward, right? So now we've established that as a foundation from which we can at least open our minds and begin to question this a little bit better from a human perspective and not get too caught up in specifically being beholden to unthinking religious convictions, because right. that's dangerous, right? Okay, so the place that I want to go to now is the modern founding of Zionism. So how did the modern Zionist movement come about? And with that, we can start with a guy by the name of Theodor Herzl. Okay, Theodor Herzl is considered to be the political father of Zionism. All right. He is considered to be the political father of Zionism. And I don't know why this is not coming up now. Okay, not sure why it's not coming up, but we'll have to freestyle this one, I guess. So Theodor Herzl, it's Theodor Herzl. He's considered the father of modern political Zionism. And he began to embark on a campaign in the late 19th century, so the late 1800s. he began to embark on a campaign where he wanted to find a Jewish homeland. All right. And his position appears, based on my research, to be truly like a benevolent one. He had good intentions. Yeah. He saw that there was persecution taking place in Russia. And it's important that we also acknowledge, like, people need to recognize that historically there is undeniably.
Undeniably.
There is also undeniably a tribalistic.
Yeah.
Irrational.
I mean, and it can be traced, you know, the Merchant of Venice. Look at Shakespeare wrote The Merchant of Venice.
100%,
which,
man.
Which encapsulates how the Jews were treated at that time in Venetian society. And that play itself speaks volumes about the kind of thinking and animosity, you know, and conflict that was taking place between the Jewish people and kind of everyone else. There's definitely been, you know, widespread persecution. The term ghetto came from, you know, that part of the world, because they were like, okay, the Jews have to live there. That is segregation.
Yeah,
you know?
Segregation.
They put them in their own little section, and they were like, stay out of our, you know, out of our business.
Yeah, 100%, man. And you know what I see that has been going on with that, because it's so polarized and there's so much tribalism, and it's really sad, man, that people just can't view things a bit more from like a human perspective. But what I see with the whole, like, you know, all Jews are engaged in this evil conspiracy to control the world kind of a thing. First of all, it just doesn't align with reality.
No.
Right? You have the WASP movement, which is the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Mm-hmm. You have elitists of all skin colors, black, white, Arab, Asian, working together historically. And you have all of these different groups, you know, Rockefellers, for example, like to use them because this is not a Jewish demographic. And yet they are incredibly powerful. You have the black nobility some of them claim to date back to ancient Rome and even to the emperors, also very powerful families. And then you have the House of Windsor going back to Saxe Coburg and Gotha and Wettin and so on and so forth. But what I see specifically taking place with this, and it's not isolated just to Jewish people when I think about it, but the Jewish population collectively are being held responsible and blamed for the crimes of the elitist elements of Jewish population. So it's very similar to people may understand it, to contextualize it a little bit differently. When all white people today, maybe they get blamed for something like slavery, when historically we know that a very small minority of powerful families were specifically engaged in these institutions.
Mm-hmm.
But through collectivist thought, through skilled propaganda, which is proliferated by the very families and organizations that were behind these institutions, then they can brand it and use it as a proverbial shield to hide behind. But, oh, it was all white people. So I see the same thing taking place.
Absolutely.
With Jewish people. And interestingly enough, a lot of people don't know this, but historically, powerful Jewish people have also undermined and thrown their own fellow Jewish people under the bus. James Lieb, for example, from the powerful Lieb banking family, he was a patron of the eugenics program in Nazi Germany. People don't know about that. That's a big deal, right? Mm-hmm. That's a very, very big deal. Another guy, I think, was Jacob Schiff, if I recall. Jacob Schiff used to give money to Madison Grant. Madison Grant was also a eugenist, and he couldn't stand Jews. He used to talk about how Jews are like these horrible people and stuff. But yeah, we have Jacob Schiff giving him money, knowing the work that he's engaged. I mean, this was essentially his primary inspiration.
He was totally a Rothschild. And what are the Rothschilds supposed to be? Right? Everybody knows the Rothschilds are, quote, Jewish, right?
And look, we're going to get into the Rothschilds because they play a massive role in Israel.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where it really starts to come full circle, and the fog of deception starts to dissipate, and you can start to make sense of everything.
You know. Let's do it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I always ask people, I'm like, now, why would the Jewish banking family of the Rothschild be one of the biggest financial supporters when you uncover, you know, when you get to the bottom of the onion of Hitler, his campaign, and everything that he was doing? Why were they one of, you know, Do you imagine that the Rothschilds came into the fortune they did because they don't know how their money is being spent by the people that they finance? I don't think so. That doesn't,
these people
doesn't jive with me, you know?
No, not at all. These people have an occult level of knowledge. Essentially, what is taking place in this world, to contextualize it and help everybody understand, is the people in power, the reason why they're there is because they have knowledge, an occult knowledge. And occult just means it's known to the few. And so they've weaponized this against everybody else. That's what banking is, guys. Banking, the way law works, right? The terms that they use, the complexities that seem so boring to us. It's in a form of occult knowledge. And they use this, you know, the product, the construct of money itself. It's a weapon, you know. And we're going to get into all of that as well. In fact, of how through occult politics, they went ahead and there you go. It's back up. Okay. They went ahead and subjugated the Middle East. And then eventually this gave rise to, you know, what took place with Palestine and Israel and so on and so forth. Okay, so yeah, we have, just to bring it up for everybody, give them a visual, Theodore Herzl. He was considered the father of modern political Zionism. Now, I've gone ahead and I've looked at this dude's diaries, because that's what you need to do. As a truth seeker, you need to go to sources, okay, to root sources, to get insights. And immediately, what we can ascertain is Theodor Herzl, he was not a religious Jew. And this is very important to substantiate and to articulate for people to fully comprehend. Being Jewish doesn't immediately mean that you are a believer in Judaism. It's considered an ethnicity, guys. And for Theodor Herzl, what he wanted to specifically do was find a Jewish homeland for nationalistic reasons. And that's because he was secular. He didn't believe in religion. So here's a conversation. This is from the Complete Diaries of Theodor Herzl. People can find it on archive.org, page 1599. And he's speaking with the King of Italy. And the King of Italy essentially asks him, are there still Jews who expect like a Messiah, which is central to the whole story of the Promised Land? And he replies, he says, naturally, Your Majesty, in the religious circles, in our own, the academically trained and enlightened circles, no such thought exists, of course. And then down here, our movement is purely nationalistic. Now, this, of course, it's a very important point to make, right? Because, again, people are very hung up on the religious interpretation of what's taking place here. So immediately we see that the founder of modern Zionism, Theodor Herzl, and we're going to get into specifically more about his story, how this came into being, and how the Rothschilds essentially hijacked the whole entire movement. But what we find is he was doing it for secular reasons. With that said, we also know that they weren't specifically interested in the land of Palestine and Israel. Okay, they were looking at multiple different lands. This included, in fact, at that time, I was talking about King Leopold. They were also interested in potentially getting a land in Belgian Congo, Congo. There was also this over here, the Uganda scheme, where they were considering taking Uganda. There was also Argentina, which is another place that they were considering looking into. And that's important to realize and recognize. Like, this wasn't specifically about Palestine, because today they want to make it in our minds about this.
Right. It was always the chosen land. It was always that.
It's always been about that. And that's simply not true. It's not corroborated by reality. And reality is just another word for truth, guys. So if reality shows that this story that we have been told over and over and over again is simply not, it's not true, then that is something we need to dig deeper into and question. So this is where it starts to get really interesting. Okay. Take a moment to pause here and look into the camera and do some speaking. During this time, Theodor Herzl, because he's not very well known. In fact, the way he got his connections was through a Christian Zionist who believed in the Promised Land. And this is why so much of the power and the allure surrounding this particular narrative and this conflict is rooted in religion, because there's always been people that have been strongly convicted. But I like to say good intentions are not synonymous with good outcomes at all.
No.
Right? Just because a Jehovah's Witness shows up at your door does not necessarily, and they think they're doing the greatest good work ever, doesn't necessarily make it true.
Right.
It's all about, you have to align yourself with the truth. Okay, that's just how it is. What we find is Theodor Herzl, in his position, he was trying to court powerful people to get some kind of influence, some kind of favor behind his specific, you know, ideal. I want to have a Jewish homeland. And at the top of that food list was at the top of that food chain was the Rothschild family, you know, incredibly prominent. I mean, when you talk about successful Jewish people, at least in the eyes and minds of the public, they're at the very top of the list. I mean, they were so tight with both the French and the UK governments, amongst other governments as well, but specifically, excuse me, those two governments. So he's trying to court them, but at the same time, he's also very much aware that they pose somewhat of a threat. So we're going to turn back to his diaries now, and we're going to explore this a little bit more. Where's the share button? There you go. All right. So we go back to his diaries. And let's go to this one first. So this is where he's trying to get approval specifically to gain a homeland. And at this point, he's starting to lean more and more towards Palestine, just to that region, which we're going to get into in a moment. Mm-hmm. But he finds that Edmund Baron de Rothschild, who is actually known as the father and the founder of Palestinian colonization, which we're going to explore in a moment, he was opposed to him. You see in his diary, page 352, right. He documents, Rothschild will hear nothing whatever of the matter. He considers what I am doing dangerous because I am rendering the patriotism of the Jews suspect as well as injurious, namely to his Palestinian colony. So before anything was going on, the Rothschilds were already in there. Okay,
we're already set up. We
100%. The first ever colony, which was founded in Palestine, the first Jewish colony over there, was established under the Rothschild's patronage. Mm. And this was in the 1880s. Okay. We see again, he's speaking with somebody, a guy by the name of Francis Montefiore, and it's page 976. And the guy's warning him, saying, look, you need to be on your guard against the Rothschilds because they would come in and take control of this notion of a Jewish state. Mm-hmm. But again, he's trying hard to court these people. Now we see on page 876, he speaks about Edmund Rothschild in Constantinople, and he says, if he's there, I suspect some type of Rothschildian
typically Rothschildian villainy. Yeah, villainy.
Right. So this puts into perspective, like, okay, the Rothschilds were well known to be a dangerous group by him as well, but nonetheless, he's trying to court these people, and there is a specific part. People can find this stuff on archive.org. If you really want, just let me know, and I'll track it down and send it to you. But essentially, he says that he wishes they would stand with him because he's doing this just because he wants to find a Jewish homeland. And he's even willing to give them some kind of power over it, but he needs to find a Jewish homeland. Like, he seemed to be very earnest in his convictions. Okay, now, eventually, there is... there we go, right, yeah. Eventually, he courts one of the Rothschild family members. And we're looking at page 1294, and they're sitting down, and he is talking to him about having essentially a piece of land so that he can build a Jewish homeland. And you see specifically what Theodor Herzl said. He said, I'm looking for the Sinai Peninsula, Egyptian Palestine, or Cyprus. And then he looks at the Rothschild family member, he says, are you for it? And then it says he thought it over with a smirk, and he says, very much so. Now, there's obviously some ambiguity there. There's different things that we can read into it. But the primary thing, again, is that this was not specifically about the land of Palestine and the proverbial promised land. This was about a region, okay? It was about a specific region of land.
You see it right there. It says, take Uganda.
Yeah, and he mentioned it. He says, take Uganda. And then Theodor Herzl says, no, I can only use this. And unfortunately, it doesn't elaborate much on specifically why he came to favor this particular tract of land, but he did nonetheless. And as we know, long story short, Balfour Declaration was issued to the Rothschild family. But how specifically did that come to be? Right. So that's where we go now to, as we were talking about Edmund Baron de Rothschild, who is this man right here. So he's actually on the currency. You can see this is a 1982 bull. That same year, he's been compared to the architect from The Matrix because of his likeness. He looks very similar to him.
Yeah.
And you see these people in the background of the notes. These are the colonialists, right? The, the so-called settlers that he helped to finance. And he essentially dictated what they were allowed to grow, what they weren't allowed to grow. Like he forced them, for example, to grow grapes, and he started like a wine business through them. And if we look at some, today they don't talk about it because it's obviously not a term of endearment, but you see in the past year we have the Jewish Telegraph Agency, 20th August 1931, where they explain that Baron Edmund de Rothschild was the father of Palestine colonization. Hmm. And then just to corroborate with another
86th birthday. Let's go back real quick because people don't understand what the Balfour Declaration is.
I'm leading up to that. Let's quickly actually just address that. The Balfour Declaration, guys, and I'm going to illuminate this with a lot more detail because that's what truth is about. It's about bringing clarity, not confusion, not leaving holes where it's nuance, like, we jump from this to this. There's this stuff that doesn't make sense. But essentially what this document was, it promised essentially the Zionist movement, and specifically, as you can see over here, hopefully they can see the writing, which is Dear Lord Rothschild, and anybody can look this up. It's very easy. You can see over here on Wikipedia, where they basically say to him, we acknowledge your rights and we will give you the homeland of Israel. So this is where this documentation and the original claim, aside from the more deeper biblical claim, to the so-called promised land arises. So this is second only to the biblical promised land claim. So this is where it comes from. The British Empire, who have about as much right as I do to grant you rights to America right now or to wherever, to India, they went ahead and they said, oh yeah, we're going to give you this land. And how this all came about is incredibly deceptive and duplicitous, and we're going to lead up to that in due time. Yeah. So just to corroborate as well again about him being recognized as the father of Palestinian colonization, we see over here with the Washington Post, this is 1979, underwriting the Promised Land. It can be argued that almost until his death in 1934, at the age of 89, Baron Edmund and the Jewish Colonization Association, which he came to dominate, or which he chaired and financed, dominated Jewish settlement policy. Now, this is so significant because when this conversation arises, people, what they do is they talk about Theodor Herzl, if it even gets that far. And they do their very best to also go ahead and make it, they almost conceal that Theodor Herzl was a secular Jew. Like he didn't care for religion. He didn't want that to be a part of the equation. He wanted it to be tolerant. And
they don't say he was looking anywhere else, you know, that there was.
Yeah, they don't say any of that. You know. And immediately now, for those who are kind of sitting on the fence, you know that that's strange. Why aren't you giving me this greater detail? Because remember, guys, truth is expressed in detail. The more you can see of the map, the more you're going to understand the truth of the map. If they're missing out very important pieces, that means that something is being concealed for you, and you need to begin to ask, why is this being concealed from myself? Okay, so going back to that now, we can start by, just bear with me, everyone. I just want to be meticulous with my sources so you can look them up and fact check them for yourself.
To make me wonder what Israeli children are taught in school about the founding and history of their country.
Oh, I can only imagine. You know, but look, we're going to get into some of the, because that's a very important component as well. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a very important component as well, guys. And for myself, in fact, that's what really disillusioned me above and beyond everything else, is I began to look at actual Israeli military testimony and special forces and people that were working the checkpoints and people that are in Palestine. That's really what hit me home. That's when it really started to get through to me, like, okay, what's going on here? It's crazy. And in fact, going back to what we were talking about in the outset of this, in the very beginning, they proclaim unambiguously that the Jewish people in Israel are so heavily targeted that when they come back and they tell them the reality, and these are the soldiers that were actually there, they don't want to believe them. They call them unpatriotic. They chastise them. They put them down. And that right there is a huge indication that of being brainwashed. So anyways, let me go ahead and jump back on you. I just want to see if I can also find, I've got a slide specifically about the colonies. So people can look up if they're interested about the first colony. It was called Le Zion. So just in case I don't find it, I don't want to waste people's time too much looking it up. But the colony was called Le Zion, L-E-Z-I-O-N. Okay, the Zion colony. All right, I'm not seeing it there. Okay, so let's just move on, but people can go look it up. Now, with that said, immediately when we have the Rothschilds family, their influence in here, we need to start to consider the time, the day and the age in which this was going on, the historical time, because oftentimes we get so caught up in the propaganda of how they frame these things, looking back. You know, right. George Orwell had a comment that he who controls the present controls the future, and he who controls the present controls the past, something along those lines.
Yeah.
And essentially what he was pointing out is that history is being controlled and written by the victors, and the way they contextualize it and teach it to us, it's very specious. It's for a specific agenda and purpose. So what we need to consider is, what was the climate like during that time, the psychological climate, the emotional climate? And at the time that Baron de Rothschild, Edmund de Rothschild, was founding these colonies, it was during the Second Industrial Revolution, which is massive, guys. That's such a big deal, because this was a key event in what we recognize today as globalization. This was like the beginning of globalization. And so railroads were being built quicker. Steel could be produced quicker. It was a technological revolution that was probably only rivaled by the technological revolution that we have taking place today. So to demystify what that means, to help people understand specifically what that means, is because there's this technological revolution, from the perspective of somebody engaged in population control, in maintaining power, which means you control the trade routes, you control the railroads, you're digging for the minerals. This is a gold mine, a proverbial gold mine. It's a time of just striking oil. And that's in fact literal, because this was the time in which they discovered oil. And the Rothschild family was engaged in all of these businesses. So an excellent resource people can go check out is in fact the Rothschild family's archive. Okay. And what's so good about it is it's maintained by the Rothschilds family themselves. And this is a screenshot from there. And this is the 1880s. And it's just showing how, and remember, in the 1880s is when they began their first colony in Palestine. Now, the significance here, again, the earth is rich with wealth. Second to the human being itself, it is the number one resource that the ruling class are trying to exploit. The first one is always the human being, okay? Right. The second one is the planet. And what we have here, just to name a few of the companies, and again, this is on the Rothschild family's archive.org. Okay. Not difficult to find out. Excellent resource. You can look up loans. It's just, for a researcher, it is a gold mine to go to, because you have a credentialed source. You know, it's coming from the family itself. Right. And yeah, they talk about how they developed their interest in mining. We see over here that they created the 4% Industrial Dwellings Company, an exploration company. There was also de Rothschild Ferries develops interest in Russian oil. All of this was going on around the time of the colonization in Palestine. Now, that's a very big deal. And then to corroborate that, just to show people the potential of what I'm trying to suggest here, this is from August 22, 1927 in the Evening Tribune, where it explains that they essentially found out after doing exploration that the Dead Sea holds trillions with a T in riches. Wow. This was in 1927, guys. That's a very big deal. And that's further corroborated by, yeah, we see in Popular Science Monthly, September 1929, the Dead Sea contains gold worth 50 billions. And it says, yeah, in fact, that it's other minerals, and that's not just the gold, but the deposits of pure potash, bromine salts, gypsum, and magnesium chloride, and other minerals valuable to agriculture and industry have been estimated to be worth $1,200
billion. $1,200 billion in 1929? Holy
That's shit. Insane. So what we can extrapolate from this, right, what we can deduce logically from looking into all of this is that, A, this was a time when they were laying down roots everywhere to gain control of natural resources, oil, mineral wealth. And it wasn't just them. It was powerful families worldwide, because this was the Second Industrial Revolution. And then we also now have, it came at a later date, but we must remember that the Rothschild family, what set them apart, as is true with other powerful families, is they always get intelligence. They get access to insights way before other governments, way before other people. So it's very likely In fact, in Theodor Herzl's own diary, he talks about encountering them, the geologists that were working for the Rothschilds family, kind of mapping out the region and stuff. So it's very likely that they had some kind of a suspicion that there is a very rich form of land.
Very good bet.
Yeah, exactly. It's a much more practical perspective, because the Rothschild family, the ruling class guys, they don't care for tribalism. They don't care for religion. Historically, they use these things as vehicles. They care about them to the extent that it helps them to accomplish their own agenda and goals.
Right.
However, it's not just about the mineral wealth. Okay, so there's additional reasoning behind the importance of this specific land, which we're going to get into now. Okay, so let's just get back to sharing the screen here just to give people some visuals. All right. What else was going on during this time? Okay. Back then, the Middle East was controlled by the Ottoman Empire. It was a Turkish empire. But at this time, the Ottoman Empire was, in fact, on its way down. So here's a comic, you know, like I said, what's true today was true 100 years ago, true 1,000 years ago. You had different personalities, and yeah, we have somebody that's just kind of using their artistic creativity to depict what's going on. And yeah, we have the Turkish Empire, and surrounding them, we have the Russian Tsar, we have the British powers, we have the French powers. And let's be very clear as well, so everybody can understand. Other major events that were taking place during this time, guys, were the scramble for Africa, the colonization of China after the Opium Wars. So this was a time where they were just digging up the planet. They were dividing it. Okay, this was a time of colonization. And so they had the eyes on this land. And what's really interesting, how we were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, using instruments of war and how they have occult knowledge, and that's how they overcome people in a very subliminal way. It's not, oh, it's nuclear wars and, you know, we've got this movie about Oppenheimer, we need to be scared. What they were actually doing on in the background, we see over here through the Ottoman Public Debt Administration. The way that the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, was being brought to its knees was, in fact, through loans from private bankers. Yes. Yeah. Yep. So we see over here a European-controlled organization that actually created this, that was established in 1881. Now, remember, we're still dealing with the 1880s to collect the payments which the Ottoman Empire owed to European companies. Now, if we go again back to the Rothschild archive over here, we can in fact go ahead and look up this information, which again, guys, if you're a researcher, go to this place, because they're going to give you this information, and it's maintained by the family. And in fact, one of the families that was issuing these loans to the Ottoman Empire was the Rothschild family. Okay, but it doesn't stop there. All right, it snowballs. The Suez Canal purchase. And let me just stop right there before we get into the Suez Canal purchase, just to give a little bit of context for the viewers. The Suez Canal was extraordinarily important in the past, guys, because this controlled the trade routes. So whoever could control the Suez Canal could control the shipping, right? The shipping that was going through the region, and they could tax that. They could also stipulate what goes in and out. It's just, in terms of controlling business, in terms of population control, it is seminal. So the Suez Canal was major. The Rothschild family, they in fact helped the purchase. They gave the loan to the British government for the purchase of the Suez Canal. Now, why is this significant in this particular regard? Because the Berlin-Baghdad Railway. All right. The Berlin-Baghdad Railway, and I'm sure you're familiar with this on one level or another, or you've heard about it, brother. The Berlin-Baghdad Railway was a deal that was being put together by the Ottoman Empire and the German Empire. And the significance of this is that it would, in fact, have sidestepped the Suez Canal. And this would have disrupted the way that the control and the flow of business was taking place, which is a massive, massive thing. In fact, today, in the past, about 10 years ago, they were very hush-hush about this. But today, it's more known, it's more spoken about, how this was a seminal event that, in fact, led to World War One. Like, it wasn't about the assassination of some shitty Archduke Franz Ferdinand. You know, that's just a silly myth that they tell us. They tell us the most ridiculous stories, you know, these fairy tales. This was a major precursor. Like we see over here, this is actually a declassified document for anybody that wants to look up a quick summation. It's from 1984, but it was declassified a bit later on, from the Defense Technical Information Center. This is an intelligence hub of the Department of Defense. And you can check out this publication, and the title basically states what it's all about: the Berlin-Baghdad Railway as a cause of World War One. So the significance here, so the significance here, guys, is in terms of this particular portion of land, there's so much evidence that indicates, from a pragmatic, elitist perspective, they just wanted to have control of this land because it's resource rich. There is so much going on around it. And to this very day, that clearly seems to be the case, is that they want to control this piece of land because historically, and we'll get more into that, historically, it's been a very important piece of land, not just to control the Middle East region, but to control the flow of oil, to control all kinds of different mineral richness, and also to control the greater grand scheme that is the global population. Because when a conflict like this takes place, it doesn't just affect that region. There's people fighting with friends, everybody's fighting one another, and it's all done predicated on this religious story and religious conviction. And the truth is, if you look at it, it's very secular, it's very practical in what truly has the more likely reasoning for why the Rothschilds came to dominate this land. Now, before I move into how what happened in World War One and the Balfour Declaration and the Sykes-Picot Agreements and the McMahon-Hussein correspondence, which not only led to the creation of Israel, but even the creation of the modern Saudi Arabian Kingdom. Before I get into that, I just wanted to take a pause and see if you have any specific questions that you want to ask in relation to some of that stuff.
No pressure. I can't think of any. No, I mean, but I'm really interested in what comes next.
Oh yeah, look, the next part is crazy, man. It's really, really interesting. Let's just jump into this.
Okay.
I'm going to go back to the sharing screen just to give people a visual.
Go for it.
All right, let's rock and roll, yeah. Okay, there you go. Okay, cool. All right, so we're going to start now with the McMahon-Hussein correspondence. So at this point, World War One has broken out. Okay, there is this secret correspondence. It was in July 1915 through March 1916 between a guy by the name of Sir Henry McMahon, he was a British representative, and then Sharif Hussein, who was viewed as being like a representative of the Arab people. He was greatly revered. They really appreciated him. And in this correspondence, essentially what took place is the British Empire, they promised Arab independence through Sharif Hussein in what is now Syria, Palestine or Israel, Jordan, Iraq, and the Arabian Peninsula if they helped them win World War One by fighting against the Ottoman Empire. And just for the sake of context, the Ottoman Empire ended up siding with Germany against the UK. Okay. So this was now promised to the Arab population simultaneously. While this was going on, almost simultaneously, a few months later, we see in May 1916, there was the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And this was between representatives of the UK and representatives of France. And I'd just like to quickly highlight, guys, when you think of a government, because we do this in a very collectivist way, and people sadly also have been so brainwashed that they start to identify who they are. They say, oh, we did that. We did that. You didn't do anything, okay? The British ruling class, the French ruling class, which represent a minority.
They did a lot.
Minority. Yeah, exactly. They did a lot. And you are now sitting with the ramifications of that. But what's really significant about them conducting this kind of agreement, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was essentially they said, look, we lying to these Arabs. What we are going to do is we're going to carve up this land amongst ourselves and we're going to split it up. And this was also done in accordance with the Russian government. The Russian government was also going to get parts of land, and so was the Italian government. The significance here as well is not just that it was the British government and the French government doing that, but behind them was the French House of Rothschild, which was funding the French government's war effort, and it was the British government. And they were also, and again, you can find all this information, guys, on the Rothschilds archive. Okay, it's a gold mine for that information. So my point being is when you see Britain and France conclude Sykes-Picot Agreement, you need to understand that it's the powerful business interests, it's the powerful bankers behind these governments as well that are involved in this. But this is incredibly duplicitous, right? So what we have essentially is they have promised the Arab population, like, we're going to give you independence. We're going to give you the land of Palestine. We're going to go ahead and we're going to give you Syria. We're going to give you all these kind of lands. And you're going to be authentically autonomous if you help us win this war. And then behind their backs, they're going ahead and they're like, no, we're going to lie to them.
As soon as it's over, yeah.
Yeah. Fuck. So again, this isn't about religion or honoring your word or being so noble and all the mythology that they teach us. This is about Machiavellian politics. But this is where it starts to snowball, and eventually we are going to get into, well, how exactly did it end up in the Zionist chants, right? Hmm. So just a further additional source, I like to give people added sources. Some people may have heard of Lawrence of Arabia. There was that famous movie about him. And this is also in his diaries over here, page 111. And he reportedly, he was suicidal. He actually wanted to kill himself because he was instrumental. He played a pivotal role in getting the Arab population to fight. So he fought alongside them. Yeah, he was involved in the Palestine campaign himself. And he basically said, look, I want to go to Damascus and I'm hoping to get killed along the way. This is in June of 1917, because we are calling them to fight for us on a lie. And I can't stand it. So that's just an additional source for people to check out.
Wow, I didn't know that either. Wow.
Yeah, nuts, man. But we led to the Balfour Declaration, right? And this then took place the following year in 1917. So how exactly did this come about? And we're going to get into that, because that's where it starts to get into the modern day story. Mm-hmm. Now, before we do, however, when Sharif Hussein became aware of the duplicity of the British government and the powers behind the British government, he refused to sign the Treaty of Versailles, which was basically the concluding treaty to the war. Mm-hmm. And for the sake of public relations, because of course they were giving people this mythological image of what was taking place, they needed his signature, and he refused to comply. He was actually very staunch in his position, and sure, he's been portrayed, of course, by British historians and many other Western historians as being just this horrible, irrational, evil human being. But he was very staunch in his principles, and that's a noble thing. Of course, nobody's without mm-hmm. faults, especially the background he was coming from. But he was very staunch in this particular regard. And in relation to Palestine itself, he was just almost, he was like immovable. He wouldn't negotiate. Mm-hmm. He said, look, you promised us Palestine, you're giving us Palestine. And that's the end of it. And a good source for people to look up is this. Yeah, this is a peer-reviewed journal. It's the International Journal of Middle East Studies. This was published in 1978, but it's still a really good source to turn to, because it gives original correspondence. And it's called A Matter of Principle, King Hussein of the Hejaz and the Arabs of Palestine. Now, this is where it gets also super interesting, man. When he refused to play ball with the British authorities, they turned to this dude, Ibn Saud, known as King Abdul Aziz. Okay, he's the first king of modern Saudi Arabia, from the House of Saud. That's where this guy came from. Mm-hmm. They turned to him, and they had this dude actually. He was on their payroll. Literally, they were paying him money. The British authorities.
King.
Oh yeah, he was their pit bull, and they had this dude actually overthrow Sharif Hussein.
Yeah.
And this was the emergence of the modern day House of Saud. Now, the House of Saud goes back much further, but in terms of the modern kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the relationship between the Saudi Arabian ruling class, or the House of Saud, and the Western ruling class, you see over here we have Winston Churchill, and then we have the king over here, and then we have goofy ass George Bush, and then George W. And we have them over there. This can actually be traced back to this same event. So there's a lot of history that we're not being told about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which it's pretty shocking. But this takes us back to, okay, well, how invariably did the Balfour Declaration come about? How is it that there was this promise to give the land to the Arabs, and then there was also this relationship between the French government and the Russian government and the UK government, which that ended up getting leaked, okay, after the so-called communist revolution in Russia, that ended up getting leaked, which is very interesting. It almost shows, because the powers that were predominantly behind the so-called communist revolution in Russia were powerful Anglo-Saxon elitists like the Rockefeller family. So it almost, there's almost like two sides warring over power. And anyways, this was leaked, the Sykes-Picot agreement, and that disrupted the whole thing. So, but anyways, long story short, we have the Balfour Declaration. So how did this come about? Now, you may have heard about this dude before. His name is Benjamin H. Friedman. You may have heard that he had some testimony online. I don't know how difficult it is to get a hold of this today, but like 10 years ago, it was just everywhere. Of course, censorship wasn't what it is now. And he went on record. He was a Jew himself, but I mean, they referred to him as a self-loathing Jew, which is a very common thing when Jews speak out.
They'd like to do that to anyone who speaks out.
I mean, it's a dismissive term. You know, it is very dismissive. Now, look, he renounced his Jewish religion and he went to Catholicism, which I don't advocate either. So I can understand the allure.
From the
pot
to the fire.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, I mean, you've done an incredible job yourself at illuminating the corruption of the Roman Catholic Church and that entire establishment. And that's just a whole nother story. But with this over here, he claimed that what happened was the British War Cabinet, the Zionists went to London to the British War Cabinet, and this is how the Balfour Declaration came about, because they were losing the war to the German Empire. And just to make it very clear to everybody, the monarch of Britain, okay, and the monarch of Germany were cousins, all right? So there's all kinds of different levels and chess games being played, right? But I don't want to assume, oh, the Germans were fighting the British. I mean, at the highest levels, it's just a poker game. It's just a chess game, and they play with people's lives, all right? But essentially, he was saying, look, the Zionists in London, they went to the British War Cabinet and they said, look, you can still win this war. What you need to do is you need to get the US to come in on your side. And then he says that they basically said, we'll guarantee to bring the United States into the war as your ally to fight with you on your side if you promise us Palestine after you win the war. Now, that's all fine and well, right? Anybody can make this kind of a claim. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. It's thought-provoking, but do we have any evidence to corroborate this? And it just so happens that we do. In fact, we can go to the Rothschilds archive once again to a source that was literally an inside man. And what do they state here? This is the Rothschild archive. Just look up Walter Rothschild in the Balfour Declaration, Origins in the First World War, and explains that the British hoped that in exchange for their support of Zionism, quote-unquote, the Jews would help to finance the growing expenses of the First World War, which was becoming increasingly burdensome. More importantly, policymakers in the Foreign Office believed that Jews could be prevailed upon to persuade the United States to join the war. So we have some evidence to corroborate that claim. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So initially, once all of this took place, once World War One and the dust had settled, I mean, so much took place there. We're still just scratching the surface. And when I say we're scratching the surface, it's not because I have this superior perspective to everybody else. I'm saying that because I know there's still a lot that I need to discover there. Truth is something that is always expanding, something we're always becoming aware of. But essentially, in the wake of that, and we'll get into this next, I wanted to see if you have any questions, but in the wake of World War One, that region became a British administration and under British control. And then that will be the next chapter that we can get into. But I first just wanted to see if you have any specific questions.
Hey, guys. Thank you for watching the first part of my podcast with Gavin. Gavin is an incredible source of information. We had to break it up into two episodes. The second one will be coming next week, part two, which will deal with the modern day era of the Palestine and Israeli conflict and how all the history we just talked about manifests itself in 2023. So thank you guys so much for tuning in. Thank you to Gavin for just being absolutely meticulous. And we look forward to releasing part two next week. Thanks, guys.